Tom Hanks starred in this summer's hit film Big as a boy who wakes up in the body of a man. And as Algene Harmitz of the New York Times put it, with this role, he crossed the line that separates a leading man from a movie star. Hanks' first starring role was in the 1984 film Splash. He played a young man who falls in love with a mermaid. That was followed by the film's Bachelor Party, Volunteers, The Money Pit, The Man with One Red Shoe, Nothing in Common, and Dragnet. In the new film Punchline, Hanks stars as a stand-up comic who's just flunked out of med school. He's the best of the comics at a hole-in-the-wall New York comedy club, and he's looking for his big break. But his arrogance, bitterness, and self-pity might be an obstacle. Sally Field plays a suburban housewife who's just getting started in comedy and wants Hanks to help her with her material. Before we meet Tom Hanks, let's hear a scene from the film in which he's polishing his timing by performing for patients in a hospital.
Another game is double up on the medication. This is, you take the pill and you put it under your tongue, and when they come around to check up on you, you insist it wasn't in the cup. And it wasn't in the cup. There's no pill there. If you were taking suppositories, you might want to pass on that whole thing.
Although Tom Hanks has starred in several comedies, he never did stand-up until he began preparing for Punchline.
We went into the clubs for Punchline, not so much for the research for the role, but to get the material the way it had to be for the movie. But I've known a lot of comedians, and I've been friends with comedians since about 1980 when I moved to Los Angeles.
When you went to comedy clubs to test out material for the movie, how were you billed? Were you billed as well, folks, tonight here's Tom Hanks, he's an actor, but he's testing out this material for a movie?
Well, that didn't happen until a little bit later on. For the most part, it was just, we have a special guy, a special guest. You know him from this thing, and he's a guy, and he's done these movies, so here you go. Here's Tom Hanks. And the reaction was always good because, I'm a relatively famous guy. I am a celebrity who has done these movies, and so immediately these people who have just come to this comedy club to see, comedians, now suddenly it's like, oh, look, there's Dr. Spock at the next table. It was one of these kind of things. But that's very polite, enthusiastic applause for about, 90 seconds. It didn't help with the act at all. The material there was always left to its own judgment. They didn't laugh any more by what I was saying. They were just a little bit more excited to see me than anything else.
Well, did you feel very vulnerable doing something that you weren't necessarily that good at when you were starting out?
Because
you're very good at acting, but you had no experience doing stand-up, and there you were in public.
That was something that I knew I was just going to have to get over. Because we knew that the comedy material was going to have to work as stand-up material. It was going to require me getting up, how many times? I didn't know, 3, 4, 5, 10 times of getting up and really just being terrible in front of these strangers. Bombing. I mean, thinking I had 5 minutes of material and having it last about 40 seconds. Jammering, sweating, getting over the glare of the light in your eyes, and you can't see these people, and they're not laughing, and you don't know what you're saying anymore. It's really a terrible, horribly uncomfortable, sensation of being bad professionally. And I knew that was going to take a while to get over until, one, I got an act, and two, I became familiar enough with the act to be comfortable with it and kind of, muscle the audience then.
What was the difference between doing your material for actual people who were there to hear comedy, and then doing it for extras on the movie when they were getting paid to laugh?
It was a battle. That was really something that had to be addressed. And to David Seltzer's credit, but more importantly, I think Ray Villalobos, who was the cinematographer of the movie, while he was setting up, while he was lighting and all that, the atmosphere could be in position and sitting down, but the microphone would be open. And so whoever the comics were, we were always spritzing with the people who were there. So it was like an ongoing performance. So when it came time to actually do the stand-up routines, all of which lasted usually about 10 minutes or something like that, they were, even though they had heard the jokes before, the comedians could then alter what we were saying. We had some inside running jokes that we could say. We were always changing the order of it, keeping these people surprised. Because they did. They had to show up in nice clothes and sit there for 8 hours listening to the same jokes over and over and over again. And we realized we just can't ask these people to laugh blatantly. We have to give them some sort of reason. We have to spritz with them. We've got to give them the zets. We've got to try to surprise them. as much as we could in the confines of having to shoot this movie. So to their credit, I think that they were very game to sitting there and doing it. We had rate the takes, you know, we had games like this. Was this take better than the last take, you know, when we get thumbs up, thumbs down? We had a pool going in which the crew would throw in a buck a piece. And at the end of the day, the person who laughed the most honestly would get the pool. Not the loudest, not the most, just the most honestly would win the pool. So we had that kind of system going on, because otherwise we might as well have had just a laugh track, you know, just on off scream, catcalls, whatever.
Did you learn new things about timing when you were doing your stand-up act?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I think they're only particular to being a stand-up, though. I don't think it was a battle of learning that the phrasing is just like Sinatra has to phrase. The way you underplay one line before you, you know, scream another one is just as important as the material itself. It's a delicate ballet.
What's the best bit of advice you were given?
Drive this horse to water.
Meaning what?
That means that even though you have said this joke a second time now, you are not laughing as much because you said it once already, you've already heard it. Now it's another time. You have to say it again as though you're saying it for the first time. Just as a horse is driven to water, you have to make this stuff be fresh and funny and just as brand new. Now, this is, you know, all part of the suspension of disbelief that you kind of have to do to be an actor in the first place,
right,
as well as from the point of view of the audience. But if you're up there saying this stuff and you're communicating to say, look, I'm just making this up, folks. You honestly have to convince them that you're just making this up. It's a discipline that is kind of, in some ways, particular to itself, but yet is also the quintessential show business performing discipline, whether you're a ballet dancer or an opera singer or an actor or a stand-up comedian. You have to make it seem as though it's the first time.
I like the laugh that you use in the movie, and I was wondering if that's your real laugh.
That one?
That one, yeah. Because I hadn't heard you laugh that way in other films. So.
There is a laugh that comedians do when they're not on stage, and I know there's a couple of guys who do it in the movie, Damon Wayans and Barry Sobel, but I've heard a lot of other comedians who do it when they're in the back of the club, either waiting to go on or just checking out somebody's act. And when they hear something that they think is funny, that's the laugh that they do. It's like that. that means that is funny. That's the highest compliment that one comedian will give to another comedian, that kind of laugh.
That's great. Yeah. That's really great.
Yeah. That's something that I found out in the course of the extensive research.
You know, I thought that a lot of comedy writers never laughed at all, and their highest compliment was just saying, that's funny.
Oh, that's funny, yeah. That's for comedy writers.
Right.
Comedy performers will actually let out that much of a laugh.
My guest is Tom Hanks, who stars in the new film Punchline that opens this weekend. You know, I think that this was a perfect role for you to have after Big. I know you actually shot the movie right before Big, but the movie opened right after Big. And I say that because Big was such a kind of lovable, innocent role. And in Punchline, you play a comic who's got a pretty bitter streak in him and who's very funny but isn't a lovable guy. And I just think it was a really nice balance to the role that you played in Big.
Oh, absolutely. I think also what they have in common is that they're very well written. They're very well defined by the individual writers. And because of that, I mean, that just makes my job a lot easier. And it's kind of the luck of the draw that I got two parts that were so well constructed and so easy to jump into. The guy, the kid in Big, it was a second skin of clothes. And Stephen, of course, that's like, I don't know, that's like a trip to the therapist's, I guess.
Did you identify with the character, with his obsessiveness?
In some ways, yeah, but for the most part, I'm just not as unhappy as Stephen Gold is. I'm not as chromosomally damaged, it seems, as he is.
You got to do some physical comedy in the opening scene of Punchline, and in several of your films you've done some physical comedy, you know, falling off of bar stools, tripping over things. And I've never figured
falling,
out...
Falling, tripping.
Yeah. How do you learn how to do this kind of thing? How do you learn that you have a gift for physical comedy?
I think you just end up doing it. You know, you just kind of imbibe. You know, when you're up doing your roles. I mean, even back when I was in college and doing theater and stuff like that, it just seemed as though those kind of demands were always came my way. And I don't think it's really, it's not a training. I mean, it's not like I studied mime or anything like that.
Or studied tripping.
I did study tripping for a while. No. You just kind of do it. You have an opportunity to manifest your character, and you ended up doing it that way. But I guess I do. Now, I don't trip that much in punchline, so at least that's something new.
Did you always gravitate to comedy?
Well, there's this theory that the world is broken up into two groups of people, the people that laugh and the people who make the people laugh. And I think I've always been one of the people who make the people laugh. Are these people born, not made, whatever. I think that because I was funny and comfortable with being funny, that gave me the courage to get up and be an actor in the first place. And because there are people who are funny, they usually get the comedic parts. So I can say, yeah, I did gravitate to it, but I really just gravitated to being an actor more than anything else. I never thought of a qualitative difference between acting seriously and acting comedically.
You've gotten to work with a lot of really good sketch comics, Dan Aykroyd in Dragnet, John Candy in Splash, Jackie Gleason in Nothing in Common. And I was wondering if you picked up things working with them since they did all these sketch comedy type things in addition to films, but they got their start during sketch comedy, which is, to my knowledge, something that you hadn't done.
No. Well, see, they also wrote all their own stuff as well, and that was really where the influence I saw. That's really specifically why I wanted to work with Dan, to see how he does this, because Dan also wrote the script that he also wrote Dragnet that we were doing.
Right.
And I've always been fascinated from that, beginning to end process of writing it and then performing it as well. John and Dan also came from Second City, which is... Probably, they wrote the book on how to do all that kind of stuff, and of course Gleason was, one of the icons of our age. But it's not what I do. I think that's what I probably gleaned from the experience of working with them, is that I don't do that. I don't take that approach.
What's the difference between your approach and the sketch approach?
Well, I think that they're much more, polarized as far as the direction that they're going, because they have the upfront creative input into it. I essentially do what I'm told. The writer tells me one thing to do, and then it's supplemented by what the director tells me what to do. And then I end up, bringing some sort of unspoken thing to do myself. That's what I do. Mm-hmm. I don't start off at the beginning. I come in a little bit later on.
Do you feel lucky to have started a film career and bypassed teen movies and, quote, Brat Pack movies? You really had your own identity right from the start. You weren't identified with a group, and you weren't in incredibly dumb movies.
There's people who will disagree with you.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, I don't. I have to agree with you. I don't think I've made a stupid movie yet. I've made some bad movies, but I haven't made stupid movies. And I think it's because of my age. I'm 32, which is, I don't know, it's not old school, and yet it's not, it's not the Brat Pack, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And part of it is also, my looks, for lack of anything else. I mean, I think I'm a relatively decent-looking guy, but I'm not particularly classically handsome. And yet I'm not peculiar enough to be like a character guy. So I don't know. I think I'm just one of these guys who, like in a pachinko parlor game, I'm just one of these guys, a ball that keeps falling through crack after crack after crack after crack until I end up somewhere at the bottom.
When you first started... auditioning, how did you test? What kind of roles did casting directors think of you for? Do you know the kinds of notes they took on you, the kinds of judgments they made about you very early on?
Well, in the early going, I ended up reading for like the weird guy an awful lot. The not the best friend of the lead character, but the guy who strikes out with the women, the insecure guy who supplements for his insecurity with being funny. An awful lot of those characters, which are pretty one-dimensional. Because of the TV show that I did, because I was, moved up to the front and was one of the main guys.
This is Bosom Buddies.
Yeah, that Bosom Buddies. I think that's where I was able to bypass an awful lot of those kind of, stupid movies, stupid roles. that you were talking about earlier. Because here I was a guy who had, I guess, somewhat an amount of emotion invested in this failure. You know, I wanted the beautiful girl and never got her. And it was from my point of view, as opposed to just being the hard luck guy, I was the guy who the audience was identifying with. But, you know, it's been so long now since I've actually been in kind of an audition process that that's what I remember most, saying, okay, well, you're funny, so do this and do it funny. That was good. Do it funnier. And I could do that, so I would do that. So that's where I had attention paid for it. But, you know, thank goodness I didn't get too many of those jobs.
Well, it's interesting. You've gotten leading man roles without being the muscle-bound hunk, and most leading men nowadays have to, like, really have big muscles bulging out.
Well, they don't have to. There's no law that's been written, but a lot of them do.
I sometimes think that there has been a law written about that. But anyways, has that been difficult to do, to get leading men roles and not be the kind of stereotyped leading man? Not have that kind of physique?
Well, I think luckily is the leading roles that I've had, or that physique was never, you know, necessary. I was very lucky, is because the first movie that I did, Splash, with Ron Howard and Daryl Hannah and John Candy and all those people, I was the lead guy in it. I was the guy who gets the girl, and that pretty much just establishes everything. That, by definition, is a leading man, the guy who gets the girl. And because it was me, well, I'm a leading man. Mm-hmm. And the muscles had nothing to do with it, certainly, I can, as the movie speaks for itself on that point. So I was just kind of this guy who I think is the point of view of the writers who write these things. They would like to have the girl. They would like to be funny enough to get the girl. And they would like to see themselves with the girl at the end of the movie.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
Well, yeah, I think that's what they do. These guys just kind of write what they would like to be like. And because I'm not particularly threatening when it comes down to the muscle department, I get the job.
Well, I guess it's comedy, too, that, you know, that maybe in an action picture you need the muscles more than in a comedy.
Yeah. I don't know too many muscle-bound comedians. Yeah. I mean, there are some.
Joe Piscopo.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, yeah, there you go. There's one guy.
Well, since you mentioned Splash, I thought maybe we'd play a short clip from it and remind ourselves of your performance in there. And this is in Splash, you play a young man who falls in love with a mermaid. And in this scene, you're coming home, and the mermaid is watching TV and weeping.
Madison, what is it?
Saddest thing I ever saw.
Man. I got his reputation. It's Bonanza.
A man killed another man and he died right in the middle of the street.
Oh, no, no, no. This is only TV. I thought you understood about TV. See, this is make-believe. This is just pretend killing that's going on here. See, now this guy, he's an actor, and next week he'll get shot on another show. When you think about it, it's kind of funny.
You mean I'm supposed to laugh?
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
I've got a kind of stupid question for you about the end of Splash when you're swimming in your suit and your shoes.
Yeah.
Was that hard to do? I mean, without drowning? I imagine you were in a big tub or something.
No, we were in the middle of the ocean in the Bahamas. Yeah. What was difficult about it was that I had iron weights in my pants. I had to wear, like, you know, they put like 10 pounds, 15 pounds of iron in my pockets, and that was difficult, yeah, because you had to swim. Otherwise, you float up to the top, you see. And we were holding our breath, and we couldn't see anything, and it was very uncomfortable. Of course, Daryl had the tail. She could move around a little bit better down there, but it was hard, but it was the grand adventure of movie making.
Were there people on hand to give you artificial respiration?
Oh, yeah, we had a whole team of safety divers and all this. It was actually very funny, the way we did that. It's one of the goofier aspects of making. I mean, here we were making this movie about a guy and a mermaid, and they swim off together, and we have 82 safety divers and, you know, air compressors and a team of mechanics.
Right. Well, I want to talk with you more about your work, but first we have to take a short break. And my guest is Tom Hanks, who stars in the new film Punchline, which opens nationally this weekend. And he's also starred in Big Splash and Dragnet, among other movies. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Tom Hanks is my guest, the star of Big and the star of the new film Punchline. You have two movies in theaters now because Big is still playing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the your boyishness really worked so much in your favor in Big. Did you ever feel that it worked against you in a movie?
No. Because I honestly don't think I'm particularly boyish.
Right. It's true. I mean,
but I know what you're saying.
I just feel that way about you having recently seen Big. But it's true. You're not particularly boyish. You were able to find that and bring it out for the role. Let's play a really short clip. From the role, and this is from Big, in which Tom Hanks stars as a 13-year-old who wakes up one morning in the body of a 33-year-old.
I want to spend the night with you.
Do you mean sleep over?
Yeah.
Okay, but I get to be on top.
Did you draw on your own memories of childhood, or did you draw more on what other young boys look like to you?
Well, it was really a dual-edged sword. I mean, because this kid was 13. That was a very specific age. And I think that probably 13 is, to me anyway, is still a much more vibrant year than any other teenage year, much more than high school. Because the body is just beginning to change so rapidly and the world becomes such a confusing place. But at that time, I was also just beginning to become cognizant of world events and world affairs. So I remembered being completely confused when I was 13. But for the physical aspect of it, that was a mental preparation. The physical aspect of it was I observed the other actor who plays the same role, a kid named David Moscow, who at the time we made the movie was 13. And he had some very specific ways of moving and, physical gestures. I also ripped off my kids an awful lot. Mm-hmm. I have a 10-year-old boy who, I observed an awful lot in order to put it all together.
You got a lot of things down, even little things like eating with your mouth open, coughing with your mouth open.
Yeah. I mean, it required a forgetting of an awful lot of stuff that I know as an adult now of what to do and what not to do. And we had, this big checklist all the time. Now, would he know how to do this? Would he be able to figure out how to make this thing work? And from a 13-year-old's point of view, I think it's, the world is still a great mystery.
Are there particular movies or actors who inspired you to want to act yourself?
Yeah, Robert Duvall was a great inspiration to me when I was younger. When I went and saw the Godfather pictures, it was Duvall's performance that made me sit up and take notice when I came out of them. Certainly, in all of the early films of like Martin Scorsese, these were guys who made me sit up and take notice. Earlier on, I always thought one of the best actors was Jason Robards. He was a guy who I would pay to walk across the street. I mean, I saw all the movies for the most part that came out. But these are the guys who I became somewhat kind of the small champions of.
But it's interesting because it's exactly not the kind of movie that you've been making yourself.
Well, yeah, I know. Well, I don't know why that is exactly. I can only I think it's because I've always been relatively funny. So to me, the funny stuff always takes care of itself, and the real challenge lies in the other areas.
So you think you've modeled yourself in a way on Robert Duvall and Jason Robards?
Well, I've tried to, but I'm not saying that I'm emulating these guys.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But I think that they're the type of careers that I've always wanted to have.
Now, you studied acting in college and did an internship with a Shakespeare festival. What kind of roles would you play when you were acting in theater? Would they usually be the Shakespearean comedies or the tragedies?
We did them both. I played Cassio in Othello and Rosencrantz in Hamlet and Falconbridge in King John. But we also played Grumio in Taming of the Shrew and Proteus in Two Gentlemen of Verona and Aguecheek and Fabian in Twelfth Night. You know, you do good roles, you do bad roles, you do comedies, you do tragedies, you do histories. That was a great thing about college and classical repertory theater is you got an opportunity to do it all. But you also did, George Gibbs in Our Town. What was some of the other things? I can't remember the resume now. But you ended up doing it all.
Has acting changed your self-image or even how you physically think of yourself? And I'm wondering if the way you see yourself on screen is different from the way you'd always thought of yourself as looking in your mind's eye.
Oh, no, it's always totally... I always hoped that I looked like William Holden, and instead I look like this other guy. That's probably a very, very difficult thing about doing what I do, is that I have to look at myself so often, and it's such a... No one should have to look at themselves that much. Or hear themselves. I have this big nose and a squeaky voice, and
that's how you think of yourself.
Well, yeah.
That's not how other people think of you.
Well, God bless him, because all I see is this massive... I keep wondering what squirrel ran through my hair all the time. It's very, very painful. I wish I had a career in radio instead.
lucky me, right? Totally invisible. Would you have marketable skills if you were in acting? Do you think of yourself as having other marketable skills?
Some sort of a salesman or something, like an insurance business. I worked in the hotels for a while. Worked in hotels.
Doing what?
I was a bellman. I was a bell service, bell boy, bell hop, whatever the appropriate term. But actually, bellman is the way you should describe them. I did that for a while, and it was, an interesting, fun job. Put a lot of cash in my pocket. But I have no idea what I would do other than this.
Mm-hmm.
I made a living for a while in the theater as a technician, as a stage manager, and as a carpenter. So maybe that. But I don't honestly think I have any other skills. I know that's probably bad to say, but this is the only thing I can really do. I've tried, even writing, which I don't have the discipline for, I don't know what else I would do.
It seems to me that this is a turning point in your career, because you've gotten so famous and so acclaimed recently. I think we've all seen actors and other performers who, when they reach a certain height in their career, lose something because of why. I mean, I don't know exactly what it is, but the engines that seem to have driven them in the first place get turned down after all the acclaim sometimes. And I wonder if you have a little plan for preventing that from happening.
Well, no, not really. I never really have. I've never been one of those kind of things. I would like to think that the reason that I've done these jobs is just because they came across and they were different enough from the other things that I've done before, and so I go off and do it. There is a fear, though, that, this is it. They're going to catch on. There's nothing else here, really. I do this. This is what I do, and I can't really explain it. So maybe this is this is my 15 minutes of fame that Andy Warhol is always talking about. But I can't change that. I think that the reasons that I went into this in the first place is simply because I enjoy it and it's fun, and that hasn't changed. So hopefully it will not change.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's really fun.
Tom Hanks stars in the new film Punchline, which opens this weekend. His other movies include Big, Splash, and Dragnet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.